The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Sky Broadband. Create, do, explore. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
Well, when it comes to science and discovery, one of the most curious aspects is space. Only a tiny percentage of mankind has ever left our atmosphere, so we're extremely privileged to be joined this morning by Captain John McBride. Good morning.
Ryan, it's my pleasure to be here with you in Dublin this morning.
Very good to see you. What part of the world are you from?
Well, I live, I'm looking across the river to the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, so I technically live in Titusville, Florida.
So you're living the dream,
right?
Okay.
Right.
Was it from childhood? Was it were you, was your eye were your eyes always diverted to
they
the
were,
sky?
They were, believe it or not. Back before we even had a rocket program, I was building my own rockets out of copper tubing and fabricating my fuel. And so we were having a good time in the mid-50s before NASA even started launching their rockets.
So you were a little boy at that time, and going into the mid-50s, not into the 60s, pop culture was fascinated by space, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yes. When we picked our first astronauts in 1959, I was starting high school, and I was enthralled and excited about that. That increased my intense interest in space. So I guess the good part of that whole thing is that I got to know all those guys.
You did, and eventually.
I met just about every astronaut that we've ever had, and most of the cosmonauts. And now we have taikonauts from China, and I know several of them. So it's been a wonderful career for me.
And when you were growing up, you would have seen the likes of Flash Gordon and Superman and Star
Trek. That's all we had was Superman and Flash Gordon.
Right, okay. And were you into all of that?
To the moon, you know, stories about going to the moon, but there were some stories of going to the moon were written back in the 40s and the 50s, you know, so that got a lot of people started back then.
And that was a time of great vision, and the likes of President Kennedy and his speech.
I'm a very fortunate American. I got to meet John Kennedy.
And tell me about
back
that encounter.
Back in 1960, he was campaigning through my little state of West Virginia. I was a senior in high school, and I read in the paper he was going to be in our courthouse that afternoon at 1600, and I said, wow, I get out of school 3:45, so I ran across town, a small town. 5 minutes I was there. I was the first person in the courtroom where he was meeting with he and his wife Jackie and one of their aides. So I was the first person in there and got to spend maybe 5 or 10 minutes with him, got his autograph, which I passed on to my son, who now has nearly all the presidential autographs.
Really?
But that's got him started.
Right.
Got him several of them in the last, I've met every one of them in the last 8 or 10. So it was a wonderful inspirational day for me to meet John Kennedy. Little did I know that a year later, after I met him and he was elected, he wasn't president yet.
Yeah.
They would make that famous challenge, we're going to go to the moon by the end of this decade. And that really got my attention.
That must have, because
every American's attention.
Right, but you particularly, because you had this nascent dream that was going to become.
We were building rockets, I think, before NASA was.
Yeah. So how did you make that dream a reality in your world?
You know, I believe in divine guidance to a certain extent.
Sure.
I was in my last semester at West Virginia University when a Navy recruiter came through in a blue flight suit, just like I'm wearing, and said, any of you came to my table with the 4 or 5 of my friends, any of you chaps want to fly for the Navy? What?
Yeah.
It's like it was guided to, and he came to me.
Sure.
I've always wanted to do that. What do I have to do? Well, the first thing you need to do is take this written examination. If you can get 80 out of 100, I can take you out and give you a ride in a Navy training airplane. Really? Mm. I knew everything about aviation and airplanes, just never had been in one. Got all 100 questions correct.
Get away.
He said, never in history have I seen this. come on, I'll take you out right this moment. I had to miss a couple classes to do that.
What age were you?
Roughly. I was 21, 22, right. 21, I think.
And how excited were you?
Oh, wow. So he said, I can take you out right now. I said, I'll have to miss a couple of classes, but let's go.
Yeah, yeah.
So
out you went.
He took me to the local airport in Morgantown, West Virginia. We went for a ride in a single-engine, two-seat trainer, the basic trainer for the Navy. And I loved it so much. He said, well, I got to get you back. I got another student coming out. If he doesn't show up, we'll go do it again. Thank God the student didn't show up. So I got to get my first 2 airplane rides that afternoon. It changed the whole course of my life.
And were you, it sounds like it was like a drug. Were you hooked on this?
It was worse than a drug.
Really?
I knew after we did, it was nice and gentle and benign for the first minute or two to see that I wasn't going to throw up in his airplane. But after a while, we were doing loops and rolls and spins and everything that you could do in an airplane. I did that on my first flight. And I loved each and every moment of it. So I think divine guidance.
Divine
I was
guidance.
Destined to fly airplanes.
You were meant to.
And the good Lord, I guess you could say, led this Navy guy to my table that particular afternoon.
And you ended up then, you saw combat in what, Vietnam?
Vietnam, yes.
Always when I hear Vietnam and America, I always think it was a very traumatic experience
very
for the country.
Yeah.
And how was it for you?
Well, for me, I was a Navy pilot. I was trained to fly fighter missions, so it was my job, and I went and did it, and I did it proudly. But looking back, you know, we wonder sometimes why were we there to start with, obviously.
Yeah.
But I, during my career, flew, I've got right around 600 carrier landings. And my takeoffs match my landings, which is a good thing for a Navy pilot.
And how do you go from a sort of military role, if you like, to something more space-related, aeronautical, in that regard?
You have to want to do it. They can't force you to do that, obviously. But I, once again, the right timing, the right place at the right time. I knew that all the astronauts before me, or more than half who came before me, were Navy pilots.
Yeah.
So that's kind of helped guide me into the Navy to start with.
And you had an engineering background then?
Yes,
and
they were all engineers, and I also knew that every one of them were test pilots. So after my first sea duty, they call it, we go back to shore, and I asked to go to, I knew all of them had worked on postgraduate degrees, so I asked for a naval postgraduate school, which I got to do. Then I went back to sea duty for 3 years, and what would you like to do now? I'd like to go to test pilot school.
Right.
Because I was kind of, for you youngsters, that's a good thing. Start, if you want to do something 20 years from now, don't wait till 19 years from now to start planning it. Start working on it today.
So off you went.
Yes. So, and even was better than that. I had good grades and good performance records and things. So as a Navy pilot, Air Force and Navy exchange one pilot in their test pilot classes each year. And I got to be the Navy guy that went to Air Force test pilot school at Edwards Air Force Base and fly 30 different types of Air Force airplanes that 1 year during my training, come back to the Navy, fly all my airplanes. And so it just enhanced my portfolio, so to speak. Yeah. So when NASA was looking for astronauts, I could raise my hand and say, I'm just as good as anybody else.
And anytime I hear about astronauts, I always think of the training and the intensity of it, the physical, and I suspect psychological demands made are pretty intense.
Well, it's all those things, but, you know, after having gone through what I did to get there through the Navy and test pilot school and career aviation,
you're ready.
If you can land an airplane on in the Mediterranean Sea at night with no stars, no, you can do just about anything.
And what about the notion of heading up into the heavens? Tell me about that as a prospect.
Oh, wow. Just the idea of it was overwhelming. To think that you get to go lift off from this Earth and escape gravity and go around. I went around the Earth 133 times.
That many times?
Yes, and you get to see a sunrise and a sunset each time you go around. And we love to sit out here on the coastline here in Ireland and watch on the West Coast go down, the East Coast come up. And when you're in space and traveling around the Earth, space rises and sets in about 8 or 10 seconds. So you get to see one every 45 minutes.
Yeah, incredible, really.
So you put all that together with the excitement of being up there to start with, going around the Earth every 90 minutes, seeing the sunrise and the sunset, but most importantly, doing some great science and research and being a part of the frontier of discovery. It's the best job in the world.
Let me play a love-hate game with you, John, for a moment. What did you love most about those trips?
Wow. I think probably the beauty of the Earth is seen from space.
Yeah.
You just never got tired of going to the nearest window if you had a few seconds and take a peek out and see where you were and the glory and the grandeur. There's nothing prettier than the British Isles.
I can imagine.
And on a beautiful day, which is rare, by the way.
Yeah, I can imagine.
I think we had one day out of the 8 or 9 I was up there where there were no clouds over the British Isles, and it's a beautiful scenery.
And what did you hate most about being up there?
Having to come home.
Oh, really? Oh, so that love and hate are intertwined.
That last day, you think, wow, we're going to have to go home today. And it's I'm just now getting accustomed to it. I'm feeling good. It takes your body a day or two or three to adjust to living in weightlessness for a long period of time. So you get accustomed to it. Now it's time to go back to that damn stuff we call gravity.
Yeah, that's how you felt.
And the first few moments back on Earth, it's like, beam me back up there, Scotty. I can't take this down here anymore. So your head's spinning around in a circle. You feel like you weigh 2,000 kilos.
Really?
And feet are stuck to the ground. And so it takes the longer you're up there, the more it takes to readjust to living here on Earth.
Did you ever have a kind of existential crisis at a human level up there about what is it all about?
not a negative type. I had a very positive feeling of...
It was enriching.
After, you know, I'm a pilot, so I'm up front, and it takes us about 45 minutes after insertion into space before we actually get up out of our seats and start moving around the cabin, have to shut down all the launch equipment. So I hadn't seen Earth for 45 minutes since I'd been in space.
Yes.
And Earth was kind of behind and below us, so I couldn't see it out the front window. And my job after 45 minutes as pilot is to move to the aft part of the cockpit and open up the payload bay doors. So I'm looking out through the payload bay windows into the cargo bay and still hadn't seen Earth. I hit the buttons and the cargo bay door started to open, and all of a sudden the Earth is right over the back of the tail. And I got to see and we were right over Australia. 45 minutes after leaving Florida, I'm on the other side of the Earth.
No.
It was even enhanced further by the fact that right here next to me was the very first Australian to go into space, and he and I got to see our first vision of Earth from space over his native country. Couldn't have been any better than that.
Amazing. You've mentioned divine provenance and divinity a couple of times in our brief conversation so far, John. And I was curious about that because I think sometimes wrongly that a scientist might have an issue with all things divine for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
And you, having been there and seen what you saw, did you ever doubt the existence of God?
No, I haven't. I as a child, I grew up my grandfather was our local Methodist minister, so I
That'll help.
Was in church in front of him every Sunday morning. So it got me off on the right path. Been a believer since birth, and I'll be a believer until I die. And having had the experience to go around the Earth and see it from that vantage point, look the other way and look at the heavens, you realize there's more than something that created what we're doing today here on this Earth. There's got to be something supreme. I don't know what he or she or it is, but I truly believe that there's a superior person that or thing or being that did this whole
thing. You don't think it was a scientific Big Bang?
It probably was, but it was led by something or somebody.
But you saw, see, there's always a divine hand.
You bet. Something divine.
Right.
I don't know. I can't get my hands around it.
We've been trying for years.
I'm never going to discount it.
I'm just intrigued by that. And then you've mentioned that you've met a heap of presidents of America.
Everybody says John Kennedy.
Okay. Who impressed you most with a handshake?
With a handshake?
Yeah.
Ronald Reagan.
Is that right?
Tremendous individual. Loved working with and for him. As a matter of fact, that's an interesting story. I was, we had our Challenger tragedy back in 1984,
yes.
I think. We were really at a loss in Houston. Are we even going to have a space program after this? And it was Ronald Reagan who decided that NASA was worth keeping, and he was going to keep it around. And I had a call from Friday afternoon from my secretary, said the president would like to talk to you. I said, yeah, sure, right, yeah. I'll pick up the phone. It was him. He wanted to know if I would come to Washington to be the deputy in charge of congressional relations, because there was a feeling in those days that Congress was going to squash NASA, and he didn't want that to happen. Would I come up and help fight that battle, which I ended up, my last 3 years at NASA, I was assistant director up in Washington, D.C. for congressional affairs.
Yeah. It meant a lot to you to have Ronald Reagan as your president.
If we hadn't had him at that particular time, we'd had a different ilk.
Yes.
Someone that wasn't a believer. The space program might not be here today. America's space program.
Interesting use of words, he wasn't a believer, because obviously clearly Kennedy was.
Sure was.
Reagan was.
Yes.
Is Donald Trump a believer? The State of the Union earlier on in the week suggests.
I've never met Donald Trump.
Yeah.
I don't know him very well. I think he understands the value of space and space exploration.
Do you? Yeah. He was saying at the State of the Union that he feels that it's time.
Yeah.
It's time for American astronauts to go back to space.
But we got to back that up with money.
And action.
You can talk about it all you want to until Congress, until he puts it in his budget and Congress approves it, nothing gets done.
The Kennedy Space Center that you see from your house...
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people obviously listening to this program haven't been there. Is it the nearest we'll get to reaching for the stars?
It is.
Yeah.
Kennedy's a magical place. Only one place like it on Earth. I've been around now since the class I was selected in 1978, the very first class of shuttle astronauts, and I've been around Kennedy Dell since then. I have the good pleasure of still working out there most every day.
Yeah. And people can say hello to you.
Driving 6 minutes from my house across the bridge.
Yeah, yeah, nice, nice. What do kids ask you mostly?
My kids?
No, what do children that you meet at this space?
What's it like in space?
Is that right?
You know, that could take hours. It depends on what aspect do you want to talk about. The launch, the landing, the on-orbit activities, launching satellites. What does Earth look like from space? It's just... kids are very interested. I was too. I think I was infatuated with space when I was 10 or 12 years old. And my nephews and I built rockets and launched them from my launch pad. So,
and the idea of other life form out there, that must be asked of you a lot.
We've tracked thousands of solar systems and other places in this universe that could harbor life.
Yes.
It might not be like us, but I'd be the last person on Earth to say that there's no possible way that there can be something else in this universe somewhere. The odds are against that.
It feels very arrogant to discount doesn't it?
We found other, just with our, by future standards, today's solar, the things we explore our universe with are kind of archaic. I'm sure in the next century or so we'll find things that can even peer further and deeper into space and maybe even find what might look like an organized colony somewhere, I think. Why would that not be possible with the billions of solar system and planets and that there's something out there somewhere?
You strike me as a man. I don't know you, John. I've just met you this morning, but you strike me as a man of. Can I ask you what age you are? Am I allowed?
Fine, I'm 75.
You look obviously much younger than that, but you're a 75-year-old man who, when speaking about space, is the boy in the back garden making rockets.
I'll never change that.
That never changes.
No.
I can see that in your eyes.
I get excited. I'd love to go do it right now.
You would, wouldn't you?
Yes, I would.
And the other thing that struck me when you walked into the studio this morning is that. You have a very Irish head on you, as we'd say.
Yes.
You look very
proudly
Irish,
of Irish heritage, obviously.
John McBride.
How much more Irish can I get?
Have you had a little exploration into your background and where that's all?
Oh, yeah. My family all originated in Donegal.
Oh, right. Okay.
But before that, they were kicked over here from the Scots back in the 1700s and during when they blew
plantations. Yeah. So that's the connection.
So they ended up in Northern Ireland. I was under the illusion for many, many years that my family came from Cork.
Right.
Because that's what it said when they registered at Ellis Island. Where do you come from?
Yeah,
Cork.
Yeah.
And that's where they got on the boat. And it wasn't until 4 or 5 years ago that I came over and did further research and found out that they were all from Donegal. They went down to Cork to get on the boat.
And so, they got there.
And I found John McBride in Cork, in Donegal.
Yeah, the other end of the country altogether.
Yes, we're like fourth generation.
Okay, population. So it's a direct link. Yes. It's been really good to talk to you, John. Thanks for coming to see us
this
morning.
My pleasure, thank you. Come and see me at Kennedy.
Oh, you better believe it. I'd love to get there.
And send all your folks down there. It's a wonderful opportunity. If you've never been to Kennedy, you haven't lived.
That's okay. Well, that's certainly definitely a nice tagline and one that I will take up on and go and see you there sometime.
I'll personally show you around.
I'd appreciate that.
Thank you
so much. John McBride joining us on the program this morning. In fact, we're giving away a trip to the Kennedy Center with the American Holidays all this week, which has been great fun, but it's been intriguing and enlightening and fascinating talking to you, John,
this
morning. Thanks for your time. The text number is always 51551.